Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much in the way you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, we thank you for your giving us that disclaimer. It's appreciated so very, very much. Tonight is going to be a most interesting call, conference call, and it's also going to announce a new pattern of the way that we're going to be doing these calls. Let me just cover this real quickly. The points of the spear is making certain that you are putting yourself in a position where you're judgment-proof. And that is, of course, with Bernie on the Saturday calls, learning how to insulate and isolate property by way of trusts and having the trustee of those trusts be a corporation sole and you're being the manager of the corporation sole. You're able to control everything that's going on, so you are in the most enviable position of controlling everything and owning nothing. That's the beauty of it. And then, of course, the Monday night call where you have GW explaining to you how to correct your status so that you are moved from being a franchise of the United States government, being a basically property of the United States government, to that of the free man and free woman that our founding fathers had in mind for you to begin with. So those are the two points of the spear, if you would. It's the same coin, just different sides. Then the Tuesday night call, tonight's call, is to hear from John on how he utilizes in his particular students' cases the standing that you have in jurisdiction and the fact that you are operating through a corporation sole, and how he utilizes those tools to augment and leverage everything else that he brings to the table. So that's the key to it. So what we're going to do from this point forward, at least until further notice, is we're going to have a different type of presentation to share with you. You're all probably familiar with a soap opera that ran for decades, like I think 30 years or plus or whatever it was. It was an afternoon soap opera. It was titled As the World Turns. Well, we're now going to have Tuesday night soap operas, and we're going to call it As the Stomach Turns. And what we're doing is we're going to be highlighting a particular student's issues. They'll be known by only their first name or the first name that we're using for them that night. And the conversation will be stripped of identifiers. For instance, if you were, let's just say, for instance, you were a boat captain, and that's you're litigating with Disney over what you were doing with your cruise ship that they had you. Well, just refer to you then as somebody in the transportation business and in the entertainment business, or somebody in the travel business, something like that. And that's how things will be worked. So the students that you're hearing, that you're listening to that night, and we're going to have one tonight. His name is Bill. The students that you're listening to tonight, or for from this point in the future, this is real and live. This is not make-believe. This is not anything being made up. The only part of it that's being made up are the identifiers, and that's it. So it's going to be making for a real interesting soap opera, and when you're personally involved with it, as the students that will be highlighted on the given nights, it really works out to be correctly titled As the Stomach Turns, because nobody likes to be in litigation. And it also then gives you the benefit of real-time exposure. Think of the, you know, if you've ever been in the military, you had the opportunity to go through basic training. Well, you're going to be in basic training, not just tonight, but every night after, for a while after this. So I think it's an exciting thing to talk about and to do, and the way to handle it. And that's what I wanted to start off with in introducing you. John will be joining me shortly. I don't see Bill here yet. Let me see if he's shown up yet. Nope, hasn't shown up yet. Oh, there he is. Okay. Anyways, so that's what we're doing. That's taking a new heading, and I hope that you're going to enjoy it. And that's where we're going to go from there. I'm waiting for John. Come on, John. It's time. Let me see if he's, you know, encourage him with a quick text. Please call now. All right. So let me, while we're waiting for him, since Bill's here, let Bill say hello to you. Bill, your mic is unmuted now. Say hello, Bill.
Good evening, everyone.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, and I appreciate you being the guinea pig here, or the crash desk dummy, for the first night out. It's quite quite brave of you.
Well, I'm just interested in helping people understand how to navigate.
Yep. Yeah. So. Well, the added benefit as well, and as some of you who are students of John, you understand it gets very, very tough in having the time to sit down with you. So by you volunteering to be the crash desk tummy that Tuesday night for this wonderful soap opera, As the Stomach Turns, you actually get highlighted for a half hour to an hour on your case between the two of you. And that's, so we're trying to kill two birds with one stone. It doesn't take the place of a private interview. Don't misunderstand that, or your private tutoring. But it does augment your private tutoring. I see John has joined us. Hello, John.
Good evening. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening,
yes,
sir. Good evening. So I've laid out for the group here tonight what the game plan is. Bill's unmuted and is here. So why don't I just turn the call over to you at this time?
Good evening, and good evening, Bill. How you doing, sir?
Good evening, John. Good to hear you.
For the class's blessings and benefit, the situation that we're going to address tonight, it turns out that there's not vaguely unsimilar situations with a couple of the other students that we currently have, and individuals that are on the call tonight. And so we thought, as Michael so carefully pointed out, that working with Bill, we could further his situation and cuss and discuss some of the finer points that might apply to all of you. So to that end, I'll give you a 40,000-foot view of philosophical situation. Anything that might be similar, some of the events and persons depicted herein, if they should be similar to anything in reality, we'll just consider that a coincidence. And the names are changed to protect the both the innocent and the stupid. but so that we can get a little bit of an overview. Bill was employed by a corporation in the transportation sector, and to that end, many faithful years driving that bus and or the truck, and very, very good. And all of a sudden, it came to a place where Bill had appeared to have there was the perception of an imbalance or a deficit or a debt by the Internal Revenue Service. And what happened was that quite without anything formal as to a court or a court order, just a letter was sent to his employer who, saying that, hey, there's a current deficiency and we would like to do some resolution on this. And I'm paraphrasing that ever so tactful and diplomatically. But the letter didn't have any court standing or any court order or any judiciary. Now, the Treasury Department, as we see it, the IRS, that's a function of the corporate structure of the corporate entity that they claim is doing business for the aggregate individuals and the aggregate country, meaning the aggregate slash or organic. And when we go back to the Declaration of Independence, paragraph 2 starts out, we hold these truths to be self-evident that individuals are endowed by their creator. So it's acknowledging a creator and an environment that some people would claim is religious. I'm a physicist. I deal in facts. And if it's not a fact, I don't, I'm not comfortable with it, even, purveying it. But the evidence of an intelligent designer and as such, is to me, is overwhelming. And I respect the intelligent designer, however you choose to address that. But the thing that's more important here is that the nation did. The founding fathers and those that penned the documents that established this country, is they believed, and in the superior documents and the authoritative writings that direct and cover all of the actions, activities, and authorities and privileges and rights in this country, they penned that intelligent designer into everything that was written. So as we move forward, the organic individual, meaning they have the breath of life, is designed and defined by that intelligent designer. They're saying that those entities, and we have to remember, the rights and authorities and privileges and amenities all come from the definition established by the intelligent designer as conveyed by the pen, those that penned the originating documents that established this country. Those individuals penned organic individuals, those that have the breath of life, that by this creator, that they're a separate and unique entity, and that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that these individuals are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and among them, indicating that there's a larger pool of rights that these three are taken from, are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And among those, you can also, if the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you can pen in there that the right to earn a living. And you have to have the capacity to be able to earn a living, to be able to buy food, to put shoes on your children's feet, to buy bus tickets for your children, or a car to get to work in, and you got to pay all these the electric bill and the gas bill. But it says that governments are instituted among men by to preserve these rights by the governed. Okay. And so the thing that's really important is that we, as we're looking at these, we begin to realize that as we begin to look at all of everything that that was addressed, when we look at Abraham Lincoln in that fateful day on November 19th, 1863, when he stood up shaking his hand saying, "This is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people," what he was doing was just quoting the Declaration of Independence. When we get into Amendment Number 9 of the Constitution, as one of the three shortest amendments, the 2nd, the 9th, and the 10th are the shortest amendments. But Number 9 says, "The rights and privileges enumerated herein within the Constitution are not intended to disparage those already possessed by the people," indicating that long before this Constitution came along, these rights were already prepossessed by the individuals. And if we look back to the documentation identified in the Declaration of Independence, we find an affirmation of those that were already possessed by the individuals and just re-recognized by the Constitution. Now, and there's multiple places in the Constitution that recognizes the Constitution. The Ninth Amendment is clearly indicates that it's not intended to disparage the rights of the individuals that are they are pre-possessed. The Constitution also establishes other laws under with which there are other entities created. And it talks about in the Declaration of Independence that these individuals are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. One thing that's very important is that, you know, that this is a function of other people, by the people, and for the people. That means that each one of you is the top of the food chain, and you have those inalienable rights. And when you don't have time, aren't able to, aren't capable of, don't feel safe doing, or don't feel you have the skill set, or just don't want to, you, the people, hire help. Aviation, air traffic controllers, longshoremen, forestry workers, patrol officers, sanitation, governors, presidents, judges. Oh, by the way, sheriffs, by the way, those last four, they're just temp help. They're hired help. They're just temp help. But those inalienable rights that were reserved for the people were never surrendered or abdicated to the hired help. It's very important to realize that they, during the time where they are serving their 8 to 5, they are subordinating their rights to the fiduciary responsibility, the position of office. And so to what happens is that question that inevitably comes up is, what about the 16th Amendment? Well, if the right to earn a living can be taxed so that if that tax is not paid, that their right to earn the living is taken away from them, or their liberty, by taking away their liberty, or the proceeds are taken away to the point where they no longer can function. Now, was the right to earn a living still a right, or is it possible that the 16th Amendment is in being inappropriately or illegally applied? And that's a good question. Now, at this individual situation here, there are entities created. Their creator is underneath the government, mostly at the state level, but underneath the government. There, what happens is that the government it begins to address some of those those entities and what's done with them. The thing that's very, very important is that we realize that these entities that were created by the government and underneath the subordinates of the government, that they are subject to their creator, just like men are. And to that end, the thing that's very important is that as we begin to realize, as we dig through the Constitution, there's some points where individuals they don't realize that there are multiple definitions and breakdowns in the government, and they're defined by the Constitution. Most people don't realize that there is a separation, not between church and state, but in when you go to the Constitution, Article 4, Section 4, and that's easy to remember. Just remember 44. What's it for? The United States, and I'll quote, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government. Now, there's a couple of observations with that first portion of that, the Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution. This is not the Bill of Rights, which has the amendments in it, but this is the Article 4 of Section 4 of the Constitution. The United States, it's indicating that there is some entity called the United States, and it shall guarantee to every state in the Union, indicating that the states are separate entities. This is right out of the Constitution, you guys. Ladies and gentlemen, this is all literally in the documents that govern our nation. Every state in this union and a Republican form of government. Now, that's another thing, just a side note. There, if you look at some business publications and some periodicals and some newspapers, one of them even has a thing. It says on their banner on their website, it says, "Democracy dies in darkness." There is not a single document that was penned by our forefathers or founding fathers that stated that used the word democracy there in any place. It's completely without any foundation. The concept of democracy as it relates to this country, there is zero to this date. There are zero usages of the word democracy. If we go to Article 6, Paragraph 3, it says the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislators and all executives of both judicial officers of, now get this, both of the United States and of the several states, well, I'll finish this one, shall be bound by an oath of affirmation to support the Constitution. Okay? But it says both of the United States and the several states. Okay? This is just one of many, another place where it defines that there is a difference between the United States and the several states. Okay? For those of you who have been, had the honor and the privilege of some time to spend on the Justice Brashear's call, or GW's call, they go into this more specifically and when you correct your status, they may be addressing the difference between the United States and the several states. So if this is something that's being addressed on that, it's very important to understand and the differentiation and why those are so critical. We cannot function. You know, there's an old saying, it says you should know the truth and the truth shall set you free. there are a lot of laws out there that are created that, and however well-meaning or noble sentiments that were within the minds of the legislators when they were creating, have questionable or dubious validity or integrity. And to that end, I'll ask everyone out of the 18,785 statutes that are within the 50 territories or 50 states and the held territories and held possessions of the United States, there are 18,758 laws regarding or restricting the use of guns or firearms or arms in general. There are 2,073 U.S. District Court or Supreme Court opinions that have gone through appeal that support the restriction of guns or firearms. They now, of all those, over 20,000 total laws and opinions that have gone up through the appellate level. On the question of gun, if we were to stand in before a justice or a bench and be asked or be charged with, say, a wrongful carry of a gun, or it had this thing sticking out of the bottom or that many bullets in it, or, you know, you broke our local rules or the state rules or the federal rules, does anybody know the question that you would ask? Bill, have you heard this before, Bill? You know the question to ask?
No, I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you for your honest answer. The question is, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it exclude my right to keep and bear the firearm in that school ground, this church, the Capitol building, let alone your courtroom? In that short, single question, all of the validity of all these laws begin to evaporate. Some people say, well, John, is it really that easy? Well, and I'll say, well, yes, thank you for asking, Bill. And for those of you who have a pen and paper handy, Marbury versus Madison, back then, this James Madison that they're talking about was the Secretary of State of the United States at the time. But under First Cranch, and you go down to 179, and the last paragraph of that opinion, it says that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void. Okay? So what it means is that regardless of how the noble sentiments or how important or what they thought that was compelling or the emotion that was attached to it, if it's repugnant to the Constitution, it's void. So in that one sentence, Your Honor, where in the Constitution has exclude my right to keep and bear a firearm in that schoolyard or that bank or this building or that building, let alone your courtroom? All of those statutes and laws and opinions that started just at U.S. District Court levels and then the Court of Appeals, you know, the Sixth and the Ninth, or they even went up to the Supreme Court. If it even goes up to Supreme Court, the opinion, and it's repugnant to the Constitution, it's void. Doesn't make a difference. You cannot adjudicate something that's illegal and make it legal. You cannot take a wrongful or illegal law and make it legal with a Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court can only rule one way, the right way. Any court can. When a matter is brought up before the court, many years ago in California, I was present. This is back in the 60s, in a courtroom when the judge says, I find you guilty and I sentence you to 3 years in Chino Men's Institution. And the defendant says, excuse me, Your Honor, this case was only brought before you as a courtesy. This is my constitutional right. You don't have the authority to overrule the Constitution. You only have the authority to support it. We were tactfully and kindly offering you the opportunity to prevent bloodshed when these officers were placed under arrest and they might find that they wanted to defend themselves, thinking that the law was correct when it was actually void. And the judge says, no, you can't. And before I could flinch, there were four firearms that had both officers that were involved with the initial arrest, two of them on the officers and two of them on the judge. And that gentleman asked him, he says, where in the Constitution is excluded the right to bear a firearm in your courtroom? He says, you've already violated your oath of office, or was that a misperception on our part? And the judge was, I was his newspaper boy. He backed down, and both officers were given suspended sentences, but he reversed his decision and demanded that the prosecutor fill out probable cause statements, and there was a trial held for both officers. And they were removed from service. They both received 18-month suspended sentences for taking this gentleman's firearm away from him on a traffic stop in Downey, California. I have to admit that everybody in the courtroom was down on the floor, waiting for the, shootout in Sioux City to occur, but it ended constructively. Since then, I have tried to learn more tactful and diplomatic ways to break questions like that now. But then nonetheless, many, many federal statutes are now proved to be illegal. And it shows the precedent that there are that there can be any, in any area, a federal statute that is null and void, or that is void per Marbury versus Madison. That's 1803, first Cranch 179. If anybody wants to write that down. Now we come up to the 16th Amendment that's being applied there. Within the corporation, there's even, a statute, Code of Federal Regulations, that allows the Treasury Department to hold its own, there's not a hearing, but their own court proceedings where they, there are their own magistrate where they allow, an assessment to be made and carried out. That is, well, wait a minute, John, you just said the United States of America, didn't you? So were you talking about the corporation or were you talking about the aggregate? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. Many years ago, about 7 years ago, there was a fire and it took our place. But one of the things that is most lamentable is the fact that we had copies of the Constitution. One of them that was obtained by my great grandfather and one that was obtained by my grandfather that both still had the wax seals on them. And we had two that were unsealed that were copies of the original Constitution. The original Constitution, the 16th Amendment, is not the same. We've had challenges and problems getting those from the Library of Congress. They say, no, there's only one now. And they've said that for quite a few years, but when I visited there, when I was there in 2003 for some Senate Oversight Committee hearings, I went over to the Library of Congress and they said, no, I'm sorry, sir, you're mistaken. And I unrolled a copy that still had the broken portion of the wax seal, a little bit of it still on there. And I said, this is what I'm asking for. And the lady looked at me and she says, sir, put that away. you know, and I says, what? She says, please cover that up, put that away. She says, and then come over to this, and I went over to the side and she said, and then I ended up getting called into an office in a back office. And next thing I know, there are four men standing in front of me. Where'd you get that? I says, this has been in my family for quite a few years. He says, and, I says, do I have a problem, you know, getting another copy of this? Well, they want to know where I got it and how I still had possession of it. But this is in 2003. And, it was clear that they weren't interested in the second copy that was in controversy to the Constitution for the corporation. They did not want that out. There's still some challenges that are clear when you look at the existing Constitution and in itself that when it talks about the differentiation between the United States and the individual states. It also states that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited to it by the states. And that's the 10th Amendment. It's differentiating the difference between these things is reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Okay. Now, what happens is that, through whatever malingering and unkindness, that occurred and came to fruition in 1929 through 1933, they began an accounting system that they record each one of you to be a citizen of the corporation. And that's what the definition of citizen is, that you're a member of the corporation. Now, if you are a member of this corporation, then what happens is, and if you leave yourself identified, and there are statutes that singly identify that if somebody propounds something, and like one of them that's common is the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, 15 U.S.C. 1692G, that if you don't challenge it, then it's assumed to be valid. And if you don't challenge it, some things, if you don't challenge them within a certain time, they're assumed to be valid. And when there are certain laws, like in California, has many, many laws that regarding statute of limitations. But if you weren't aware of the statute of limitations, they offer an additional year in most cases from the time that you became aware of the challenge of the statute of limitations. So at this juncture, because the United States is a corporation and it considers you a member of that corporation, then technically you're responsible for the debt. And at this juncture, there's a lot of individuals that make the comment. Justice Breshears is one of them. He says, if you're eligible for the benefits, then you're liable for the debt. And, that is very, very true. But if you acknowledge that I am not a member of that entity, nor do I, at any time did I subscribe to it, then you've officially given notice and, in many cases, and I saw another one just recently, one that was just delivered this week. Congratulations, Jennifer. But the passport cards that the beauty of this is that you don't have to argue or say very much at all, but there's that little stripe on the mag stripe on the back, and that when they run it through the mag stripe swipe reader in their patrol car or at the you know, downtown courthouse or whatever, and they realize that you are not a corporate asset any longer, or that you may never have been, or never are, or just aren't, the rules are different. Bill had his wages garnished under the presumption that he was a corporate citizen. Bill is in the process of challenging that. The Treasury Department, in an effort to prevent individuals from correcting their status, we have one or more individuals that are on the call tonight that that were prevented from correcting their status and getting it, well, not just preventing from correcting the status, but they were prevented from getting a passport. The status correction may have been updated. We haven't had a chance to verify that in the computers yet for this one individual. I'm going to grab something to drink here for a moment. But they definitely won't issue a passport because he has outstanding IRS liens and levies. Now, in some cases, that's, somebody says, wait a minute, you know, if you can't correct your status, then how do you tell them that you didn't know it? But if you, you know, there, so it creates a, well, you can't get there from here. Well, to some degree, that is true. It just makes it harder to correct, and it becomes more time intensive. And so, what happens is that the issues here become very, very specific. That it's what happens is that they have to literally be able to do it the hard way. And I say do it the hard way. In U.S. versus Slater, 545 Federal Supplement 179 to 182, it's a 1982 decision. Unless the defendant can prove he is not a citizen of the United States, the IRS has no right to inquire and determine tax liability. And you can Google that, U.S. versus Slater, but what happens is that, sometimes you have to educate the people. You've heard the story about, no state driver's license that I've shared. Some of you have heard that. Well, what happened was, is that very tactfully, I educated not the, just the judge, but the prosecutors and the officer that was present, to the point where the judge voluntarily, unsolicited, he says, you know what, I'm going to dismiss this charge against you. And but if you can, there's something about a saying of, you know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Well, what happens is that the if you can educate those that were, that would stand against you, and you can do it pleasantly and friendly, not the moment you shake your finger at somebody and say, you low-down slimy scum-sucking bottom feeding so-and-so, you know, first thing that happens is everybody gets defensive, and lines of communication they get shut down, they don't even exist. But if you say, well, Your Honor, that's a good question, did you want an answer? Or if you say, you know what, that's a very strong point. You know, I have to object, but I think, you know, that's a very strong point, Your Honor. I have to object because how does that fare in light of this statute or this law? What's the court's opinion on that? You know, and so what happens is that that old saying about you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. The more you know about your rights, the stronger you will be able to not necessarily cuss, but discuss those in a case, especially if it ends up all the way in a court of law, there's an old saying that says, if you find yourself being sued, settle with your opponent before you get to court, lest he hand you over to the magistrate and the magistrate hand you over to the jailer and you're not released until you've paid every penny. Most of you probably know where that came from. It's out of religious text, Hebraic Christian religious text. But what happens is that doing this right so that you don't end up in court is very important. And especially like we have individuals on the call tonight that their status wasn't corrected, and they got stopped for this or that, and officer not realizing that this wasn't a corporate citizen wrote that individual a ticket. And so the Internal Revenue Service, not realizing that Bill was not a corporate citizen, has issued a notice of or a letter indicating that they wanted his wages garnished. So now this is the part where we're going to open up to a Q&A. I'm opening up early, a few minutes early, because we're going to talk with Bill here. Now, if Bill is currently unrecognized is currently recognized as a corporate citizen, what's the first thing we need to do? Anybody? Or Bill, you, if you want to.
Correct my status.
Absolutely. Now, once our status is corrected, then should we bother to notify anybody? Anybody have an answer? Should we bother to notify the IRS or anybody else? Or should we take an attempt to write maybe not a too windy and War and Peace letter, but maybe a letter to the place that he used to drive buses for and trucks for? Should we write them a letter and see if we can educate them? Anybody?
I wonder if it might be a two-step approach to both the IRS and also to the payor.
Right. If they're most of these people that are quote unquote authorizing and carrying these garnishes through, chances are they think, maybe even believe, they're doing the right thing. So if they think and believe they're doing the right thing, are we just going to be able to get them to stop and by saying no? Probably not. If we can educate them as much as possible, candidly and succinctly, in a one-step letter where the individual is doing the garnishment, and then when we start, how do you eat an elephant, anybody?
One bite at a time.
One bite at a time, yeah. So are we going to try to educate the transportation company or and the IRS and the government all in one shot? That's an elephant, isn't it? That's probably not going to work out. So if we start with one individual at the transportation company where Bill was a bus driver and a truck driver, and we win that person over to the point where they say, holy kitty litter, Batman, this guy's right. I shouldn't be garnishing him. You know, why am I garnishing him? But then we educate them enough that they can carry it up the food chain so that they take legal under their wing and say, and the legal says, legal tells them, oh, no, it's hoopla, that's a lot of hogwash, you know. But if we win this person over first and we slowly work up the food chain to the point where we get legal saying, when the IRS writes them a letter saying, hey, wait a minute, under this, this, and this statute, under this, this code, you know, and the Constitution here and this there, how is it that you can ask for a garnishment against this gentleman who isn't even technically under your jurisdiction? And then all of a sudden the lights come on. I've been to Provo, Utah, where lights at the Provo IRS station in 2004 and 2006 and 2007, three separate events that I was there where individuals says, no, sir, one of them asked me to go out to the parking lot. You know, and she met me out in the parking lot away from where the cameras were. And she said, sir, there was a lady in California, in Central California, that this thing happened, and we've been told not to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, as she began to tell me this, I realized this was my wife's sister that I had written that letter for some years back, less than 10 years earlier, but it had a profound impact on the folks at the IRS office in Provo, to the point where they had memorandums, letters that were handed down that on they changed the way they did business there. And so what happens is that with Bill, we absolutely want to start with an educational process at the base, and we want to try to do it in a non-confrontational manner. Otherwise, if we, you know, if I want to be a bull in a china cabinet, I can run them over with pleadings, and it can be a very, very expensive proposition. And running the pleadings, and Bill has already had some experience at trying to deliver a bill of particulars to a court and then demand that these other individuals show up. And the judge just scratches his head and goes, pourquoi, you know, and I'm going to make you liable for their court costs and their expenses too. Bill has already been through that the hard way, and he had to pay for everybody's expenses on it. Now I've on the basic for my evening, I've run 2 minutes over now. Bill, questions, and what would you like to share about your situation before we open it up to everybody? Thoughts just based on what you learned tonight.
Well, when I approached it, I went to the payor who had been given the notice of levy from the IRS, not an actual levy, but just a notice of levy from the IRS. And I had sent the IRS an affidavit to sign saying that they had the authority to do, or was this IRS officer, revenue officer, had the authority to do what she was doing. And I sent a copy of it to the attorney representing the payor. And the IRS revenue officer contacted me, and she said she'd been told by her legal counsel not to sign the affidavit. And it had about 15 or 20 different points on there. And the attorney representing the payor said that it was not his position to demand that the IRS prove her own authority to do what she was doing. And so, I suppose if my status had been corrected at the time, that would have shed a whole different light.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm in the process of trying to find out.
Okay. Now, if we had educated the payor so that she realized the gravity of the situation, that you weren't technically legally liable for those statutes, do you think that she would say to the IRS, hey, wait a minute. You guys are asking me to do something illegal. Please show me how this is not illegal. And what I've done is I've talked to many people in her position through this, saying, let me ask you a question. If this lady's statement, and I'll refer to one situation with feminine gender, if this lady's status and everything she's saying is correct, and this is dead wrong, wouldn't that constitute a criminal act on your part?
Now, let me. Are you talking about? I'm getting lost here. Are you talking about the lady being the IRS representative or the lady being the payor?
Oh, okay. I'll thank you for correcting that. This discharged employee who was still she was fired was we had an opportunity to go to the to the legal department and payroll at her this is a records keeping company, and they granted a special grace, and I asked them, and I says, you know, now this is the evidence of what her status is, and this is the United States Code, and I even reviewed a little bit of Constitution with her, with the legal and the payroll department, and I says, if this is her status, then could it be considered that what you're doing is illegal and wrong under the following statutes? And I quoted her a chunk of 20, them there, a chunk, both the payroll and legal, I shared with them a bunch of 26 USC. This is actually the days before the internet was in effect, and I had the copies, and I actually had them certified copies of 26 USC, the statutes. I says, and one of the legal department, he leaned over the table and says, let me see that. And he picked it up. He walked out, stormed out, came back, and he had four copies, one for each of the other people also. He says, I think we've got a problem here. And I asked, do you think that constitutes a criminal act on your part against this employee that was terminated, you know, that she, you know, and but she was doing everything exactly right. And they all agreed when I asked that question. The next thing I knew, they had had meetings with the Treasury Department, IRS. They invited me to come and help with her meeting, in the meeting, and speak with her and for her there. And she used a clever technique. She says, I don't understand all this legal mumbo jumbo, but this guy, he explains it and he makes it simple for me. And she says, if we end up in court, and they were all, the moment she ended up in court, she says, I would like him to be with me. But that, she did a Freudian slip there. But what happened was that we had a short meeting. The IRS is, they wanted to confirm her status, and they did. And the company had educated the IRS and Treasury agents on the law and the statute and even the Constitution for us. We educated them. The company educated the Treasury agents that were involved in it. Now, one of those Treasury agents got into a tiff with her, not her supervisor, but her manager, because the supervisor was on board. But this was out of the Carson office in Southern California in Los Angeles there. And she ended up getting terminated because she was ordered to run over Sylvia and just push it through. That was a bunch of bull crap. And she was 61 years old at the time, and she couldn't get reemployed. But what happened was is that we politely served her manager with a petition to discuss his legal views with the court in front of a bench. And he resigned. The IRS dropped Sylvia's charges, and the complaint and all of the assessments and everything. But Sylvia, she was, when this started, she was 58, and when we finally got it wrapped up, she was 61. So she wasn't quite the spring chicken that that has a lot of vim and vigor to go fight these things. But what happened was is that the company that she used to work for ended up pushing her case, her and her cause, and pleading it with the IRS up the food chain. Is that something you think we could do with you, Bill?
Well, I'd like to think so.
Sick and doggy.
Yeah.
Okay.
When do we start? When do we start?
Hey, I'm thinking either 2 weeks or 4 weeks. As a, I apologize, I've got just students that have moments in front of it that some of them were, one of them were tenuously trying to, he's doing an IRS case right now, as a matter of fact, and they, justice found him in contempt for, this is a good point, for, identifying that his status, and the judge demanded that yesterday, on last Thursday, that he demanded that on Monday you pay $5,000 fine for contempt of court, or you will serve an indefinite term in jail, in prison, at Club Fed, actually. And I've already put some nickels on the commissary account for this individual, but so that we, but I got a text about 40 minutes before we came on this call that he is still awaiting detention, but more so the Deputy Attorney General, DAG, we call him DAGS for short, has been taken off the case, and that he's been replaced. And, but, this student has not been picked up yet by the feds, by the marshal. And, so we're watching this one literally day by day. So there's, there was an old, a gentleman that, that made a comment, he said that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time by the blood
of patriots.
Patriots and tyrants. Yep. And so what happens is that it's very, very, Thomas Jefferson was very, very, candid and succinct with that. And, you know, I wish I could say to each one, every one of you, that, you know, you shall correct your status and you'll improve your flight and you'll have a better life. For the most part, most of the people that we know, it does. There are some people that they're just, you know, however you slice it, nobody's going to believe them, and they're going to continue to pursue them. And to that end, I've taken a personal consideration to stand by this gentleman and help him get through this. Thomas Jefferson's he had a lot to say there.
While John is bringing this into view, I want to interject something here and then come back to John real quick, and that is, there is a thing that John and all the information providers deal with on a daily basis, and that is what we refer to as being on front burner, and being on the front burner on high heat with the water not just boiling but boiling over. These people fall into two categories that get immediate attention, and basically everyone is dropped at the moment other than those that are on this front burner with the water boiling over. Those are people that are facing immediate incarceration or immediately being put out on the street through a home foreclosure type activity, something that is critical to your freedom or your loss of a place to sleep. Nobody likes to sleep out under the stars unless they want to call it a vacation, intentional camping. So I just want to share that with you so that you understand and have the expectation and then the understanding, because there's some people that I see on this call that we've been, or, you know, the information providers have been, you know, spending a lot of time, not directly working on your case. A lot of times that the information provider is building tools with another student who has a more immediate need or a crisis, but that tool is directly applicable to what your need is. So it's not a direct relationship with you, but it's an indirect relationship with you. But the bottom line is that everything is prioritized according to how close you are to that front burner. It may not be something that you like to hear, but it's the reality. And if, in fact, it was your mother or your father that was on the front burner, I don't think you'd bat an eye to step back and say, no, I understand. Take care of that. And I just wanted to share that with you and interject that while John comes back. Thank you, John.
Thank you, sir. The 56 signers that signed the Declaration of Independence, every one of them was a very wealthy man early on in life. All but one of them died a pauper. Those men, in signing that document, knew that if their cause was lost, that they could all be hung, drawn, quartered, disemboweled, etc., but they would be put to death. And there were capital, that was a capital crime that they were committing against the King of England by signing that Declaration of Independence. How many of us would be, if there was a roll call vote, would be willing to stand up and be counted as number 57 in that Declaration of Independence? There are some individuals that right now, as Michael pointed out, they're close to the fire and boiling over, and there are some that we've had to prioritize. But just because their liberty or their residence is at threat right now. When I commented to Bill about it might be 2 to 4 weeks before we tear into that, that's praying that the fires of the individuals who have come up to us are not hotter. And that doesn't mean that somebody, we may not find somebody that they're scheduled for detention tomorrow, and we need to create or educate them on what it takes tonight. One thing that's very important is that the personal time we spend with the individuals is very, very important, because it's very specific to their situation. We take time to educate them, and we may even produce, they say, well, if I was in that situation, John, or if you were in that situation, what would you do? What kind of pleading would you put together? And I might say, well, gee, Bill, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. And I might put something together and run it past Bill, and Bill might accidentally say, oh, wow, John, this is exactly what I was thinking about. This is exactly the approach I was thinking about. You know what? I'm gonna make just a few minor corrections, maybe the date, you don't have any problem if I send this in, because this is exactly what I wanted to do. And, hey, yeah, that's way above my pay grade. That's, I'm just the information provider, but the decisions are all made by you, all of you. But with that, as much as possible, like with Bill's situation, Bill's is very dire. Now, thankfully, he doesn't have something crouching at the door, waiting to, with a pair of handcuffs in one hand and while they're knocking with the other. But we still want to get Bill's taken care of as quickly as possible. And the more of those type of situations we get taken care of with Bill, the more that pays to making the rest of ours easier. You should know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
Okay.
To you,
let's
Michael.
Let's open up for Q&A. Yeah, let's open it up for questions and answer. Klaus is first in line, then followed by Michael. So let me unmute Klaus. Welcome back to the call, Klaus. Good to hear from you.
Can you hear me all right?
Go ahead. Perfectly
First of
clear,
all,
sir.
Would you please repeat slowly the question to ask the judge where you started off, Your Honor, where in the Constitution, and that from that point it got muddled, and I couldn't understand any of the words after that.
It would be my honor and privilege to repeat that. Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it preclude my or exclude my right?
Wait a minute, slow down, because I'm writing this down here as you go. Where in the Constitution does it
exclude my right?
Does it exclude my right
to keep and bear a firearm?
To keep and bear a firearm or firearms?
Yes. Either that or, and you can add in there of any configuration if you want to, because there's people that, now here in Texas, you can build your own silencer now. We've, the last election, we, all the ATF statutes are null and void here in Texas now. But, you know, where in the Constitution is it my right to keep and bear arms or firearm? And you can, and if it's a configuration issue, you put the word configuration in there. In that schoolroom, you know, or that place, or that bank, or that church, wherever they say, or that government office, but the school is usually the best test on this. Where in the Constitution does it exclude my right to keep bear firearm in that school, or this place, let alone your courtroom?
For this place, for what?
Let alone your courtroom.
Let alone your courtroom.
Where in the Constitution does it exclude my right to keep and bear a firearm in that school or place or whatever you got cited for, or they, whatever the other person got cited for, let alone your courtroom?
Okay. All right. Very good. A couple of other short little things here. Number one, my understanding of the definition of legal versus lawful is that legal is the absence of God's law, which is kind of interesting. But legal, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong or if I have some other things to think about, legal concerns statutes and codes. Lawful concerns Constitution and God's laws. Correct? Wrong? Right? What?
I have heard that argument before.
Because I think words are very, very important when you go into any kind of an arena, and you need to know exactly what your meaning when you say a specific word, like democracy.
Which doesn't exist. I found that so few people know the difference that when I go, that if I'm writing or suggesting pleading, or if I'm actually in court, I give the definition. I say, Your Honor, by the definition of legal, this or unlawful that. I would like to address this as a lawful issue here under the following statutes or the Constitution. And that's the way I handle that. Because
okay.
Most people, there's so much judiciary, and I've had, in the last 4 months, I've had three gavels and gowns that have pointed out, they said, actually in the last 5 months it's four, that have pointed out on some issue, John, I have never understood or heard that before. One, I use the term gown to refer to the feminine gender of a justice and the gavel to the masculine gender. But she said to me, she said, John, I never understood this before. I was helping her with somebody else's case that she asked me for help with. And she said, I've never heard this before explained this way. I never knew this. She says, can you break this down into a third grade reading material? And I says, for who? She says, for me. I says, you have a PhD in law. She says, I know, but I never understood this. This is so clear and succinct. And you made it so simple. And she said, I need to, and she says, if you can keep it under two or three or four pages, I'd really appreciate it. And at that time, I had a 78-page brief on it.
Yeah, what was that in reference to? What
well,
was the subject?
That subject material was on a foreclosure issue.
Oh, okay.
On wet signed notes for foreclosure.
Oh, okay.
Now, there's actually been another judge that called just 2 weeks ago, and he said, were you the one that I got this card from? I says, what do you mean? He says, at the 2000 Republican Senatorial Convention in San Antonio, Texas, were you the one that I got this card from? I says, what's on the card? He says, 18 U.S.C. 242, Declaration of Civil Rights under color of law, 241, conspiracy to deprive somebody. And on the other side, it says, where in the Constitution is excluded the right to keep bear a firearm in your courtroom? And I says, you know, and he identified himself as a justice in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area. And why is this coming up? He says, well, I've had a couple of firearms charges today, and they're all sitting in my marshal's jail, and one of them gave me one of your cards. And he says, it is your card, isn't it? He says, we got it from you. I says, that's true, yes. He says, what am I supposed to do? We have very strict laws about, the carry of a firearm here in the government buildings. And I says, well, that's a good question, Your Honor. I says, did you want an answer? And he's talking to me on the phone, and my wife is overhearing the other half, my half of the conversation only. But I says, under 18 U.S.C. 242, would you be potentially committing a felony to deprive him of that right, or if you were to affirm that law? He says, you don't understand, Mr. Fiala. He says, there's these people, the two people that authored this bill, I encouraged them to get it, you know, to author it. You don't understand. You know, I says, well, would that be potentially considered a criminal act, a felony under 18 U.S.C. 241? And he goes, look, are you going to continue to be an ice hole? You know, and I says, sir, no disrespect. I'm just asking you questions to lead you to the right answer. He says, well, G.D., give me the right answer. I says, sir, it would. If I feed a man a fish, I fed a man for a day, but if I teach a man to fish, I fed a man for life. He says, okay, I give up. Ask your questions. And, so I asked him through, and all of a sudden he says, you know what? I've got to go release these guys right now. And I got to dismiss these charges against them. And I'm going to catch the flurry of my, the prosecutors here. They're, I says, well, I tell you what. Don't just do it. He says, what do you mean? I says, you said prosecutors plural. He says, I've got two that were in court today, and he says, I've got five of them, and the plus the attorney, the district attorney, that they're going to all, I says, invite them to lunch. It's still morning. It's still early. Invite them to lunch. Tell them you're going to buy them lunch, and then explain what we just talked about. He called me back at 5:30 that night and says, all the district attorneys are in agreement, and they made, we brought them back into court, and they made motions to dismiss. I says, so your name's not on the bathroom wall anymore, is it? He goes, you don't understand. He says, I called up both the legislators that I encouraged to do this, and they're a little teeny bit upset with me. And I asked them, I says, well, you know, and I told them, I says, remind them of the noble sentiments that they had when, you know, what everybody had when you guys enacted that law. He says, well, we're going to work on seeing how to correct this. That was less than 2 weeks ago that phone call came in.
Oh,
so,
educating
the people is very, very important.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
You know,
when you get stopped on the highway by a road agent, the very, very first thing you have to do and figure out how to do is to lower his aggression level when he comes to your window.
Right, right. And you know what? And to that end, I found that what I like to do is reduce the tension. I make sure the window's rolled down. I make sure when I get stopped that my the ignition is off, my keys are on the dash just out of reach, the wallet is open to my identification, I keep my insurance paperwork in the visor just over the head, above my head, so I put it on the dash, and I put my hands at 10 and 2, make sure the window's open, and you know what? It's amazing how that kind of lets the valve stem out of their excitement, you know, when they come up and they see you, and I turn on the interior light. I make sure
that's all part of reducing the aggression level.
Good idea.
I have one last question, unless something else comes up here. How do you prove a negative when you're saying you have to prove you're a U.S. You have to prove you're not a U.S. citizen in situations? The other side has a requirement to prove that you were a U.S. citizen. You can't prove a negative all the time.
Well, turn it around so that it becomes so that you you make it a positive. Instead of saying prove I'm not a U.S. citizen, then what you do is you say please prove I am. But see, the thing is that right off the bat they're going to say I got your passport photo right here. You know, I got et cetera, et cetera. And they'll tell you right off the bat that I got this, I got that. So before you're asking the question, if we educate them on what a U.S. citizen is, and we say, hey, well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. Or, before you write that up, let me ask you a question. Are you aware of any jurisdictional challenges that could possibly come back on and create a prosecution against you personally?
Yeah.
You ask the officer that, and would you like to know if there were some? And so what happens is that now you've asked him a question. You haven't told him. He's not getting defensive on you. What's happening is that you've been kind and respectful to him. And so what happens is that now he says, well, you mean a threat to me or could pose an arrestable threat to me? And then most of the time they'll say, yeah, I want to know about that. And then go ahead and tactfully and pleasantly explain. And right now I'm in the process of trying to write this into as few lines as possible. with references so that within a minute or two, I realized the need to be able to explain this to an arresting traffic officer that, and I'm trying to figure out the tools to use to support this, because you have to show them that there are two different entities, the Constitution, Article 4, Section 4, Number 44, and then 63 is the next one, Section 6, Paragraph 3. Those are the ones that you want to focus on, because they make it very, very clear that there's a big difference between the government and the several states, and then make it clear that at this juncture, I'm a member of the several states, and the jurisdiction here that it appears that you're working on is for a corporate or state or corporate citizen, and how does that apply to me? You know, and so I'm in the process of going through right now and creating the a short script. It's and I've just started doing it because of three cases that are currently pending with current students, that two of them are on this call right now, to make it easy for the unchurched individual to be able to ask the right questions and win the peace officer over, say, well, you know, when they're done, the object is to say, well, officer, what do you think about this? You know, what is your take on that? And and if we can win the officer over, and that's usually, and that, for those of you who remember the case about the driver's license, the no state driver's license, I will tell you that I did explain the whole thing about the driver's license requirement to the officer, and he asked me, he says, could I please give you a ticket? You know, and I says, why? I said, well, I said, yeah, I'm honored to accept whatever ticket you might, citation you might want to honor me with. And he goes, why do you act that way? Why you say that? I says, well, he says, you realize you have to go to court now? I says, yeah, I don't have any problem explaining this to the judge. And he says, well, I says, so why did you want to write the ticket? He says, I says, I know this is a hit and run, but if they find out that you didn't have a Texas driver's license and I didn't cite you for it, I could get reprimanded. And he says, I've only been with the department for 5.5 years. I've seen people with 10 or 15 years get reprimanded, lose out on promotion. You know what? I says, write it up. Bring it on, you know. And, you know, this peace officer, this Houston HPD, Houston police officer, you know, we parted famous friends, and you know what? When we got into court that day, you know, when he was right there and he wanted to see the whole thing, and oh man, it was we parted the court with the judge, famous friends, you know, but we did it tactfully with respect.
Yeah, that's I believe the best way to do it. Or just the thought occurred to me from some other people in my group here. I have nothing in my possession that proves that I am a U.S. citizen.
Or nothing that doesn't prove it. Correct? You have nothing
I
does
would
or
have
does
have
not
that would prove that I'm a U.S. citizen. Otherwise, it's a presumption.
That's correct. And you know what? And these guys, you know, when a bellboy does a good job or a box boy in a supermarket does a good job, you know, and so carries the lady's groceries out to her car for her, or that bellman loads the gentleman's clothes or unloads his taxi and takes him all the way up to his room and hangs him in his closet, and the guy crosses his palm, you know, somebody crosses his palm with a 5-spot or a 10-spot. But, you know, if an officer goes out and does a good job and makes a legitimate arrest, most people, you look in their eyes, it's like they want them to suck on a 38 caliber straw, you know. And very counterproductive, very counter-motivating. If you're out there with these officers and these deputies, treating them with dignity and respect, it goes a long way, because unlike the bellman or the box boy, they don't
get... Well, the other side could use some of this same advice, because there's so many times that I've been stopped over the years, the individual always comes up with a chip on his shoulder. And that's what gets things started. And I try very hard to lower that aggression, but not everybody does it, and that starts it off.
Yeah, well,
they don't view the respect of being a human being or a man or a woman. They come in, you know, trying to fight the battle right from the start.
Well, and to that end, you and I both know why. Their job is highly counter-motivating. They are not the bellman. You know, they're the individual that's getting accused, abused. They try to do a good job, and somebody wants to blow their brains out. You know, but now you and I have never been one of those people that have been on the way home and all of a sudden, you know, we're running late and we had a hard day at the office the woman that is suffering that time of the month, or the guy that has a migraine and, you know, and oh no, the red and blue bubblegum machine is out, you know, and you and I've never been in that. And so, but these guys, all of a sudden, you know, they, their life is being threatened because they're, and friends of theirs are being killed, when they try to do a good job. And so to that end, you know, this, we the people, now if more people acted like you, where you give them dignity and respect, you know, and you try to, you know, like you were saying, diffuse the situation, lower the DEFCON level, you know, from global thermal nuclear war, DEFCON 2 or 1, down to peacetime at 5 there, you know, see, if more people are treating them with dignity and respect, and I'll have to be honest with you, I try to chuckle with them, and I say, you know what, I'm honored to accept whatever citation you would give me. And a lot of people say, John Hook, well, I doubt you would ever say that, and in fact, I don't believe you did. Well, my son, who had the dubious honor and privilege of being present with me when I got stopped for on the way home from the airport with his adopted grandmother and some other friends in the car, and I got jerked out of the vehicle. I got detained and went to jail, and I had double pneumonia, and he was only 5 when that happened.
What was the so-called charge?
We had been at the range earlier in the day before we stopped to pick up my grandmother at the airport, and in the back of the Suburban was my range bag, and it had a pistol in it. It wasn't loaded, but they cited me for unlawful carry of a weapon. And what happened was that not only go ahead.
I was saying there's something cited for unlawful carrying of a weapon. No, it was lawful. The Constitution allows you to carry the weapon. It might be illegal, but it's not unlawful.
Yeah, exactly. At the time, I was being respectful to the deputy, but he was young. He was new to the force. And his watch commander was out there in one of the cars. He was saying, you did a great job, this, that, and, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, so I chose not to argue anything on the side of the road there. when we got into it.
Well, listen, I'm going to let you go to take some other questions. I've taken up enough time here.
Before you,
God bless
you.
Good evening.
Before you go, Klaus, you have a group of people there. I would strongly encourage you and ask as a favor that you share the phone number and PIN number and the time for these calls that we're doing Monday nights, Tuesday night, and Saturday night, respectively, with GW, John, and Bernie, to encourage them to be on the calls and to share.
I have a mailing list of non-government people of about 450.
Well, I'd love to have them on the call.
That's part of my People's House group.
Uh-huh. Most excellent.
The other 200 is the Iowa legislature and the Nebraska legislature.
Sick and doggy. Yeah.
All are welcome.
Well,
thank you, sir.
And we have monthly meetings.
Hopefully we all can make a difference in this nation. Just one person at a time.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing it for about 26 years now.
Yeah, I might have been part of it for over 50.
Yeah, I can understand that.
It's my honor and privilege to serve my fellow person. Okay. By the way, anybody with questions, you can field the questions to either Bill, who is our guest this evening, or myself, and you can talk about any subject. It's an open subject right now, okay? Go ahead.
Yeah, we start with Michael, followed by Jennifer, followed by Tom, followed by Kent. And we don't need any more because we're actually past your bewitching hour, John, but let's go ahead. Michael, try to keep everything tight. Please.
Real quick, the 1935 and 1938, the Supreme Court ruled ATF unconstitutional in the continental United States. They moved them offshore to Puerto Rico. The next thing is that statute that says unless it's rebuked, objected to, or rebutted, that it stands in their court, it stands. But their court is a corporate court, which is a court that works on continuous criminal fraud to commit continuous criminal conspiracy to commit fraud upon you because there's no full disclosure of your status and what their status is. So it's I think a mailing list and everybody needs to get their everybody they know, make up some cards, put this number on there, and get this out there and get more. Because one at a time, you won't get there but in two or three light years. But if everybody puts out 20 or 30 cards in a day or a week, you'll start getting this out there and people will start listening and getting an education. But I'm just old and stupid.
You know what? I may have stated that wrong. When I say one person at a time, I take one or two people, and you know, I try to be at least two people at a time, maybe three max, and I try to share with them everything that it takes to, as much as I can, to be successful at restoring liberty to America. And then what I do is as they begin to take two each, and what's happening is that we've got groups of people around the U.S. that it started out with one-on-one. And in the last 2 years, the numbers went from five digits to six digits. And it's growing quite rapidly. And a lot of the people, I don't even know who they are anymore. But what I did was restoring liberty one person at a time has just meant that if we take the time with a single individual to educate them, and we make it so that they can educate others, then we'll have done it right. At least that's my perception.
Well, we need to force the school boards to teach the Constitution because the word illegal is not in the Constitution. It's lawful and unlawful, I believe. And
that's correct.
If they start teaching the Constitution, then this program could be put out there. I mean, it's we've been indoctrinated for so long until it's just it's
you mean drinking the Kool-Aid so long?
Yeah. Yeah, but just one other thing is you said who would be number 57. I'll volunteer to be number 57, and I'll be your Huckleberry. And that's what I got to say from them.
What a funny guy. Hey, yeah, consider yourself Sky Five.
All right, thank you.
Because I can't physically come in contact with you, but I'm waving my hand into the sky, and so give me a Sky Five, brother.
All righty. Next is Jennifer. Go ahead. Please keep it tight, Jennifer.
Okay. I'm going to make it just two quick questions. The first one is, what year did the corporation, the United States Corp, actually begin, where one of the definitions in Black's Law Dictionary, was added under the United States? Do you know what year that would have started?
I sent that to you. It's 1871. That's when the corporation came into existence.
Oh, okay. So it was that. Okay. And I don't have Black's Law 1, 2, or 3. I've only got 4, 5, 6, and 7. So do you know if that definition of United States is in 1, 2, or 3, Black's Law?
You know what? I have a copy of the first edition. But it's on digital copy, and I just got it. I'm still building my library since the fire. So,
right.
I did have a second edition, first edition, a second pressing of the first edition Black's Law before the fire. That's a good question, Jennifer. I need to look that up. I guess we, Did Michael Colligan set the appointment for you and Anita for tomorrow? Already?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
From 11 till 1.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else?
Do you have anything else?
I mean, it's just that some of these people are given bonuses and stuff, like the jails. All the jails are privately owned for-profit organizations. They get an prosecutor that gets someone to go to jail gets a bonus. So, you know, it's kind of hard to change their mind in a lot of cases, you know. That's all. And the IRS, too, you know, if they get money out of people. And the credit card companies that, you know, won't let you pay off your debt, the longer that you're in debt, the more debt you can be in, the more they get paid. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All righty. Thank
you. Thank you, Jennifer.
All right. Next is Tom, followed by Kent. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? Brother John, Mike?
Yep.
Good evening, Tom. Yes, sir.
Okay. Good,
thank
good,
you.
Good. I'm trucking up here in Wisconsin, going to Minnesota. I just seen an alligator on the side of the road. But you guys can think on that, and I'll explain that to you later. But anyway, I like what you said about a 3 or 4 page report rewritten up, because when I was in court and I put my 27-page jurisdictional in, which the court has not answered. It's been going on 11 years now, and the court has not answered it yet. They couldn't answer it. And I did everything like what you were talking about and everything. But the judge kept looking at me and says, give me something to go on. Well, he negated it by giving me that public pretender, so I really couldn't speak. But he kept saying, "Is give me something to go on," and he said, "Shorten it up." You know, he wanted it refiled or something or whatever. But anyway, later in my case, I was getting pretty upset with things, so I put a judicial notice in, and the judge never said much. He was just kind of sitting watching this. But in my judicial notice, I used some statutes. And, guys, what's the name of the company up in Minnesota that has all the books for the statutes and all that, the big company that everybody...
Westlaw.
Westlaw, thank you, okay. No, Westlaw. You got it, Westlaw.
Westlaw.
Well, I, I used a couple references out of that, used statutes and everything, and the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor, the government prosecutor, said that he was going to get me for extortion and doing something else because I was not a licensed barred, I mean, I was not a licensed card-carrying bar association attorney, and I had no right to use that as a private citizen. Well, one minute, you know, I'm not the private, next one I am. But he got pretty uptight, and the judge kind of just negated the whole thing again. He just said, well, your attorney can bring this in and that. But, man, that prosecutor, he was all over me.
Tom,
if I would have not.
Tom.
Yeah?
Tom, you should have got on your hind horses, right, the hind haunches right then and there. Say, sir, are you a member, a licensed member of the bar? And he's going to say yes, because he just did. Say, great, would you produce your license, please? And show us the license that you have? Or do you have only a membership card? If you have a license, we'd like to see it because you told us. And how does that conflict with, and then name the two or three cases that talk about the practice of law is a common law right, which I can give you if you need. Just wanted to share
that
with you.
I've learned a lot. This was back in 07, and I'm learning a lot. I'm ready now. Boy, I just can't wait to get in front of these pretenders again sometime now. But I'm just trying to put this out to the public. I mean, you know, we get all excited and we sit home and write all this stuff, and then we get in there and it's a little bit different. But I think the judge knew what was going on, and the public pretender and the prosecutor, you know, they're not going to admit to it. They got to just keep the fire out. So I just wanted to share that. I thought that was really great, Brother John, when you mentioned keep it short and right to the point and give them something to go on. They always want something to go on. So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I got to go back and see if I killed this alligator.
Yeah, I was probably giving you directions on how to find them down south.
Hey, Sikkim Dog.
No.
Hey, Tom, real quick, I'll...
Yeah.
There, we had a Child Protective Services case. I walked in. I was their amicus curiae. Well, I was in a wheelchair. And the prosecutor and deputy prosecutor, the deputy DA and the DA were both there. Two attorneys for CPS, Child Protective Services, Texas, were there. We're just kind of meandering in front of the bench who's not sitting there yet. And she says, well, what law firm are you with? You're here with the defendants? I says, yes. She says, what firm? I says, oh, I'm not. She says, oh, you've got your own shingle. I says, no, I'm not. And I says, I'm not actually a licensed attorney in Texas. And she says, what state are you licensed in? I said, none. She says, what law school did you go to? I says, well, a couple, but back in the 70s, it was USC. And she all of a sudden went very quiet. The moment the judge got there, she says, Your Honor, this guy's impersonating a lawyer. He's practicing without a license and this and that. And the judge, he says, wait a minute, hold on. He's finished settling his papers. And he says, now, what are you saying again? He says, this guy's not a licensed attorney. He's here with the family. You know, he's practicing law without a license. He says, is that true, young man? And actually, he was about my age at the time. But I says, Your Honor, that's a good question. Did the honorable court really want an answer? And he goes, well, when you put it that way, yes, I would. The honorable court would like an answer. I says, well, Your Honor, if a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, correct? He goes, oh, yeah. And the prosecutor was objecting. Where are we going with this, Your Honor? He says, he says, please be quiet. I asked the question. And I had a couple of these cases like this where the judge actually asked them to be quiet. And they did. And I says, well, if my chosen pursuit was jurisprudence, does that mean that if I don't have this license that I can't earn a living and pay my bills, et cetera? He goes, I see where you're going with that. He says, do you have anything else you want to say? Would it be the honorable court's perception that under 18 U.S.C. 242,
that this would constitute a deprivation of civil rights under color of law and a second-degree federal felony. And he goes, you know what? I'm going to rule it's okay for you to plead this case with these people. He says, now, how are you appearing again? I says, well, amicus curiae, Your Honor. He says, do you know the meaning of that? He says, well, I might. He goes, friend of the court. He says, how can you be friend of the court? And I says, well, that's a very good question, Your Honor. Did you want an answer? And the female attorney general at the, or district attorney at the time, she object. And the judge says, young lady, please, I asked the question. And he says, well, how can you be here friend of the court? I says, well, if CPS didn't really have jurisdiction over the children, and not over the parents either, and this was kidnapping under color of law, and the prosecutor was trying to, and it was both of them now, object, and I just quiet, and they went on for about 10 or 12 seconds, and in a courtroom, 10 or 12 seconds is a long time. And he finally says, look, you two, please, no more objections. I'm going to have you removed. But you can't. He says, I will. He says, I will. And we'll get your other assistant in here to plead this case. And they be quiet. I says, Your Honor, and they were trying to get the court rule on it, then would that potentially constitute conspiracy and accessory during and after the fact? He goes, I see your point. He says, so what is your point? And they says, well, Your Honor, it's our job to go first. He says, I says, didn't I ask you two to be quiet? And the CPS attorneys are both objecting at the time. And I says, look, these children have no birth certificate. There's no marriage or license between the parents. CPS doesn't have jurisdiction. I says, where does CPS get their jurisdiction? It's the Own Property and Able Act of 1854. And it says, and that allowed product of a marriage to become property of the state, but it allowed two separate entities to be joined together that were slaves. But the product of that relationship was property of the state. And they had to have a license to be married. And the judge looked at me. He says, that's where that comes from. And I says, yes, sir. And he says, do we CPS have to, a marriage license to enter into evidence here or a birth certificate for either of these two children? And I says, you know, or for either of the two children. And the two children were not present and at the time, but the other five children were in the family. And bottom line was they were given X amount of time to get the children back to the parents, and the matter was done. But the handful of things occurred there. He affirmed that you didn't have to be a barred attorney to plead a case. That was the big one. There's a bunch of others that happened, you know, the jurisdiction of the children in the state. But actually, there was one more hearing after that. I had double pneumonia, and I wasn't able to finish the hearing, so I actually hired somebody else out of my own nickels, because this was a pro bono event, to plead the rest of the case. But there you are, Tom.
Thank you. Yeah.
Back to you, Michael.
All right. Last question is from Kent, and then we're going to go home. Go ahead, Kent.
Good evening, Mike. Good evening, John. Good evening, Bob. My question could be a little long, and I want to preface it with a couple things. So would it be better if I see it's already after 11 o'clock. Would it be better if I just held it to next week? Because I'm looking for some explanation about this, and I don't want to hold the whole call up. So,
well, I tell you what. Give us a pricey, and let's plan on addressing this next week then.
Okay, so you want me to just hold it, or you want me to just, basically
give
you a 40,000
foot. Give us a 40,000-foot view of what you got, and let's go from there.
Okay. What I would like you to do is address the issue of how we're dealing with an administrative branch of government, with the State Department, when we're talking about dealing and doing everything within the truth, and how this administrative agency exists lawfully, that we should even be talking to them. Now, I don't want to talk about just what's practical to do and somebody gets a card. So, as you said before, it makes it kind of easy on the road. You know, I'm interested in this from a more technical point of view, if you will. And part of the reason this comes up, but not totally, is because I just finished a rather lengthy discussion several days ago with a former New York City detective that's now retired, but is now head of security for a hospital. And I've been involved in discussions with them regarding their policy on masks, et cetera. And he told me, he knows me for several years, and he knows, you know, how I think and what I'm doing to a certain extent. And he was saying that, you know, they're starting to have issues with people coming in saying I'm sovereign citizens and I demand this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he was pointing out a number of things to me about, you know, how he views this. And apparently, you know, I don't know whether he comes from a background in New York City and dealing with diplomats, but he seemed to know something about passports. And he wanted to talk about the fact that they were travel documents, that the government as it now exists can only issue passports to their citizens. And if we're claiming to be state nationals, they really shouldn't even be talking to us or saying anything to us, et cetera. So I want to take into the picture of de jure and de facto, if these statutes are corporate, they belong to them, not to us, that a lot of this is under color of law. And I wanted to discuss that, about how you put that together and still keep it within the realm of truth. But I don't want to be ridiculous about it when, in fact, you have something administratively, so to speak, that works. But to me, it's just not, even though it may work, it seems to me that there's a couple of holes that can be poked into it. So that's what I wanted to discuss, and I was looking for feedback, which I thought might get into a discussion, which would take, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, whatever.
That's a very, very good question, Ken. Let me ask, I'm going to ask just a couple of questions. One, is the State Department part of the corporate or the aggregate?
Well, I would think at this point in time that the people that are sitting there filling the chairs and that have the lights on, so to speak, would be
No discussion. Just answer the question. There's a one-word answer either way, corporate or aggregate.
Well,
Which one is it?
I'm going to say corporate then, but I don't like one-word answers on certain questions.
Very good. Very, very, very good. Candid and succinct answer. Okay, now, if there's a question about your status or your citizenship, if the corporate is considered potentially the challenge and the State Department's the authority of the corporate for the dealing of state status as far as citizenship, would they be the best people, if there's an argument with the corporate, to identify that they're the authority that you're basing the information on and that it's in their repository?
Well, they might be the best people. I can't give you a one-word answer on that. I think they might be the best people if you didn't know there was another place to go, or you didn't realize that maybe you could do this through a common law court or a common law procedure.
Well, the answer is either yes or no. Do you think the State Department, the corporation, will recognize their own State Department's affirmation or denial of your status? Yes.
Well,
no?
I think it appears at this point in time that the answer is yes, but that doesn't mean that
okay.
It's going to be that way forever.
Very, very good. Your answer is absolutely correct. They recognize their own State Department's classification, and because the State Department is keeping the records right now, and they're entrusted with that, that's the reason why we're using their documentation and, even better yet, their information system, so that when your passport card that's encoded with a specific serial number, when it goes to a scanner, that it also triggers because it has the State Department authorization code on it, it triggers a download to that portable data terminal. that identifies, oh, wait a minute, this guy is not a corporate citizen. So does that answer your question?
Well, not really, because I really think that there's a possibility that this should be done with a court proceeding rather than just an administrative procedure if we were going to do it totally within the troop. I'm not saying you agree. That's why I'm throwing it up for discussion.
Well, if we can get it done and get the adjudication completed without having to go to court, without having to take time to educate a judge or a potential jury or a prosecutor or anyone that would stand against you, and hopes that we could win the case, and there may even be less than a 50% chance of winning just because the people don't have the capacity to understand it, let alone actually understand it and are able to weigh the facts. Wouldn't it be easier just to get the status corrected and move on?
Well, that goes back to what I originally stated. I wasn't looking at this just from a practical point of view. I'm looking at it from a truth point of view and a more technical point of view about what is really the right way to do this so it has lasting traction. I mean, there's going to be people, as was said about Bernie, you know, who takes himself out of the system and does rescissions and revocations, power of attorney, signatures, et cetera. But then, you know, you're essentially finished with the system and there's no going back. So, I mean, we all have different levels that we want to achieve. So I'm not talking about what's the easiest thing to do. I recognize what the easiest thing to do is, what you're doing, basically. But I'm suggesting that that may not be, for those of us that are interested in the more technical aspect of it or a more thorough aspect, it seems to me that we're not doing this totally within the truth. And I say that to say that the questions that this gentleman asked me about, you know, well, wait a minute, they should only be dealing with their citizens, not with somebody who isn't one of their citizens. I mean, I think those are valid points. I'm not concerned about his points or afraid that I couldn't argue against them or rebut them. I'm looking at this from a truthful point of view. And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse. I don't want to rain on anybody's parade. That's not the object of this. The object of this is to, you know, have a constructive thinking process here as to really how should this be done. So when I look back at the 1802 law, for example, the naturalization law, you know, that should be a relatively easy court procedure. Now, I'm not saying that they won't throw up roadblocks, et cetera, but, you know, that's the way it was done back then. And certainly that law was in place and has never been repealed, to, from what I can find out and to my knowledge. That was in place well before the Civil War. Excuse me.
You make the comment that we're doing it the truthful way, you know, that you're more interested in doing it the truthful way. You're implying that there's something that's non-truthful about what we're doing. Can you please explain what's non-truthful?
Well, I wasn't trying to imply that it wasn't truthful. I guess what I'm saying is, I don't want to imply anything, actually. I want to say what I'm thinking and what I'm meaning. I think that this country was set up, and you can correct me if you disagree. I mean, I think this country was set up to basically the three branches of government and not an administrative branch. So I see that if we're going to, you know, conduct ourselves and behave within that system, what we continually talk about, the founding of the country, the founding documents, the founding fathers, that we ought to be doing it under those principles, not some fourth branch of government, which is administrative, which just happened to come along. And so they recognize this. So that's the fastest way to do it. I mean, look, it works. I'm not challenging that. I'm not saying that you're filing any papers or recording any papers that are less than truthful. So there was that was not the implication I was making. I was making the implication, or I was saying that, you know, we're dealing with a fourth branch of government that I just don't see that we should acknowledge its existence.
And what's the definition of this fourth branch? How do you define it?
I'm calling it the administrative branch.
Okay.
Where does it actually exist? Well, from what I see in my experiences in life, I've concluded that it exists. But I guess one might argue that, you know, it's really the judicial, but just in the judicial in a different form, not in the aggregate. I don't know. You know, you have to ask, John, where does all this start and stop? You know, can we ever make it totally right? And the answer to my own question is probably we can't.
Well, there was a case in Kimball County, Texas in 1998 where an elderly lady was being charged with, in this case, unlawful carry of a firearm. And the judge was saying, well, she made all the arguments, they're all the correct arguments, that, and the judge says, well, I'm sorry, I'm the one in charge here. And her daughter stepped up and says, her daughter was 56, stepped up and says, I'm sorry, Your Honor, you just violated your constitutional oath of office. You don't have the authority to. He says, I'll tell you what I have the authority to do. And she says, you're under arrest. She says, the bail started to head over to her to arrest. He says, arrest her immediately. And she pulled out a .44 Magnum, shot the bailiff in the right shoulder, and shot the judge in the neck. He died right there. This was in 1998 in Kimball County. By the time, and that was about 11 in the morning, by 6 o'clock, they had not arrested either one of them, and they hadn't even charged him, and they ended up going home.
Mm-hmm.
The point was is that nobody wanted to see an 84-year-old and a 54-year-old, both widows, on the 6 o'clock news with a judge that violated the Constitution, the law, from the top to the bottom. You know, mm-hmm. And what was that thing somebody was talking about earlier, or actually I think it was me, about the Tree of Liberty, you know, and
watering over flood. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and that you are the highest level of authority. Those employees will only, you get away with what you allow, and I and everyone else allow them to get away with. Now, I'm not saying that that's the right course of action, but in that event, both those widows made a point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't, I don't condone that. And they, to this day, every once, it's rare, but once in a while I can find something on the internet about it and then it disappears. It's because I keep looking, you know, they're doing an ongoing good job of, you know, keeping that one under wraps. But there's a lot of those that have happened like that. But it's just, I don't, you know, I'm not suggesting that anyone should, you know, but of course, then again, on the opposite side of things, you have to ask yourself, should we all be prepared to do that? Because if the judge is breaking the rules and he's just hired help and he's just temp help and he's committing a felony, the only reason U.S. Marshals and sheriffs have the right of arrest is because we, the people, have conferred that onto them. They applied for a job. We hired them. They're elected officials. The sheriffs are, not the U.S. Marshals, but the sheriffs are elected officials. They applied for a job. We, the employers, hired them, and we conferred on them the right to make the arrest. The people have never surrendered or abdicated their inalienable rights to the hired help.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you believe that you can't do that, you've already surrendered your rights to the hired help. So it brings back to the question, what are you doing about it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you know what? If you'd like to continue this discussion on next week's call, it would be our honor and privilege. Michael, what would you think about the topic of next week's call being inalienable rights? And we'll swap things out, and we'll make next week's call inalienable rights. And we'll invite him back as our guest speaker. What do you think?
Works for me. I did say to the group when we opened up this call, it might have been a few moments before you arrived, that we were going to attempt a new format wherein we kind of mimic the afternoon soap opera as the world turns, to have a Tuesday night soap opera as the stomach turns. which you coined, by having one of your students to integrate with you like Bill did tonight, so that you know, we all can benefit from what you're teaching that particular student, but also to assist you in having some FaceTime, if you would, with that student, and, you know, kill two birds with one stone. So I don't know how you're going to mix it together, but whatever it is you want to do, it's your call tonight, not mine. I'm just the moderator.
Don't shoot me. I'm only the piano player.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
Let me apologize for coming on the call and saying good evening, Mike, John, and Bob. I got him mixed up, and I see his name is Bill, or hear his name is Bill, so I apologize to him for misstating his name.
You can call me Ray. You can call me Jay. You can call me Ray Jay.
Okay.
Just don't call me late for a meal, because I work for food.
All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Come back Tuesday night. Please, please, please tell your friends. Share the phone number and the PIN for this call. And share with your friends, because we all can learn from each other. John has a quote that I'm going to ask him to share with us tonight. I hope he remembers which quote I'm talking about, but he learns from everyone. Go ahead, John.
Every man is my teacher that I might learn from him. Every man is my superior that I might learn from him. Thank you.
Yep. So join us next week. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.